Welcome to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I'm Kyla Daw, and I'm glad you decided to join us on today's episode of the show that is shaping how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Rather than advice from experts, our listeners want to hear the insights and ideas from those who, just like them, are on the front lines every day, building meaningful relationships that translate into meaningful support for causes that they and their donors care about. Every week, we invite our guests to have a real conversation about what it means to be a fundraising professional. We're after a greater understanding of what it means to be one of the sector's critically important yet least understood roles, while giving honest answers to our profession's most difficult questions. Thank you for joining us in this episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Here's your host, author, fundraiser, and master trainer, Jason Lewis.
Hi, podcast listeners. This is Jason Lewis, and you're listening to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Before I introduce today's guest, I do want to thank our sponsor, QBAC. QBAC is a next-generation advancement solution that reimagines alumni engagement to drive giving. QBAC's proactive, personalized approach to engagement helps you build your major gift pipeline even in a time of social distancing. QBAC's AI-driven system uncovers actionable insights about alumni interest and connections and automatically delivers them to advancement professionals for use in cultivation. QBAC is a force multiplier for development officers, enabling them to focus on what they do best, developing deep relationships with individuals and converting them into active donors. Learn how to raise more money with less by going to www.qbac.com to schedule a free demo. I would also like to tell you about Responsive Fundraising's training. If you are looking to align your team around a shared understanding of effective fundraising, let's talk about our four frameworks. If your culture doesn't feel right, before you begin any significant planning, launch a capital campaign, hire another member of your team, let's ensure everyone is on the same page. How about inviting us to be on site with your board, leadership team, volunteers, and staff for your next planning event? If you'd prefer a virtual seminar, we can do that too. Let's get your team thinking more critically and carefully about the road ahead. Shoot me an email. I'll also put some information in the show notes.
Hi, Stephen. Good morning. Glad to have you on the Fundraising Talent Podcast this morning. First and foremost, how about we ask you to introduce yourself and remind me where you and I connected, because I'm trying to connect the dots. I think I've got some. I think I've got my dots connected correctly. But how about you remind me of that just to make sure I'm correct?
Okay. Well, I'll start with that one. So okay. we met at the Foundation for Fraternal Excellence virtual seminar last August 2020. We couldn't meet in person. We were virtually, and you did a great job with a open session seminar piece. And at the end, you plugged the fact that you hosted a podcast. And if anybody thought they had something interesting to talk about, that maybe we could connect on LinkedIn, and that's how it all started.
Okay, that's good. Okay, and so what is it, Stephen? So you work in that world. So what does that mean? Who are you? And now I know exactly where we start. I even remember what I talked about in that particular session. So I'll know where this conversation may or may not go. But tell us about yourself.
Yeah. So this is my second life. Fundraising is something that I ended up in after 28 years in the United States Army. I was a combat engineer officer, and I retired in 07, and I went back to my alma mater, Monmouth College in Western Illinois, to give back. You know, I wanted to do something. I got my commission there, and it launched my career. And I ended up in advancement or development, and within about 2 years, I figured out that I was pretty good at it, and I enjoyed it. It was like a second passion, and I ended up being vice president for development alumni relations at Monmouth College. I stayed with them for 10 years, and then Fidel found me on LinkedIn, and I work for – I actually run the Phi Delta Theta National Foundation, nonprofit foundation. It's headquartered in Oxford, Ohio. And we've got about 174,000 living alumni and about 14,000 undergraduates on 200 college campuses.
Well, Stephen, I don't know if in the brief exchange that you and I had, if I sort of connected the dots on your military career, but I think in the 200 plus episodes we broadcast here on the podcast, I think you are my first guest, and you may be the first individual that has had a full, like, full military career similar to my father. So my father, bring you up to speed a little bit on me, and I don't think I've talked about my dad a whole lot on the podcast, but he spent nearly 35 years primarily with the U.S. Coast Guard, and originally enlisted in the Army, met my mom in the Navy, and then spent most of his career in the U.S. Coast Guard. So I grew up as a coastie kid, as they call us. And yeah. And I got three uncles, two of which were also retired from the U.S. Army. I got to tell you, Stephen, I don't know that any of those gentlemen's military career would have prepared them for a subsequent career in advancement. So you're going to have to connect the dots for me and explain to me how your military training for 28 years prepares you to do fundraising as successfully as it has.
Yeah. So one of the things that happened when I was getting ready to retire is the military put us through what they called green to gray training. Yeah. So it was basically Army green to civilian gray suit. And it really got you reflecting on your career and thinking about attributes and traits that were transferable in terms of managing budgets and, setting appointments and being prompt and self-study, preparing yourself for things that you never done before, but having the courage to do them, to take them on. And so when you started road mapping out the things you did within a full career, I was in operations, I was in admin, I was a commander, all these things. So I mapped that out. So when I went to that interview, I really spent most of my time talking about what I could do for them based on these skill sets, and they bought it, and they gave me kind of a serendipitous moment. They gave me an opportunity to apply it, and it turned out really well. And so I actually mentor officers through Military 5 program. I've got a young man at the language school in Monterey, California right now. He's a major promotable who I'm mentoring. And one of the things we talk about is, keep track of those attributes and those skill sets and the things that make your heart bump and that you could maybe be passionate about when you get out. Because I think so many military people, I don't want to dominate your podcast here, but they put khakis on and a pullover after they retire, and they go to work in the defense industry because it's what they know. I challenge them to think beyond that, have a different career.
So Stephen, this is my show, but this is all driven by whatever it is you bring to the podcast. So usually I ask my guests to bring to the podcast a big idea, a bold opinion about the fundraising profession that we share. So what's your opinion today?
Yeah. So one of the things that actually your seminar did for me at FFE is it got me thinking about how so many of the sorority and fraternity, that industry, fundraising,
Sure.
Those foundations live or die by how they annual fund.
Right.
And so you see a lot of effort going into the annual fund because that's what determines, we have a recession, a pandemic. Are we going to lay people off? Oh, how's the annual fund projections going to look? And the board's focused on the annual fund. And I would suggest that they need to think in terms of changing the way that they budget. And the annual fund is just one lever towards their success. If they're looking at being self-sustaining, you should reward your major gift program, your major officer's work, and your budget should be, okay, we have a 2% I'm just going to throw this out there. We got 2% administrative fee for handling major gifts that go into the endowment. So we give this organization 0.5% to manage that endowment with the Board of Trustees oversight. And we keep 1.5% and we don't put it in, you know, the slush fund or the everyday general fund. We reward the advancement team by saying, you have 1.5% for your budget. Now, what does that do to your annual fund requirement? So what I'm saying is, I think too many people say the foundation operations are specifically annual fund subsidized. And I'm suggesting you rework, the, my colleagues rework their budget and talk to their board about how developing a more robust major gift program can not only support endowment growth, but can help sustain annual operation in conjunction with the annual fund. And I hope I said that
right. I think the challenge that I don't think it's the annual funds in particular, but I think it's anything that's driven by, and I may have talked a little bit about this, and I certainly think this is along the lines of where you're getting, and you correct me if I'm wrong, but I think what we're basically talking about is anything that's driven by volume and efficiency, like the engine on an automobile. If there's not constraints put on it, if there's not a governor put on it that says, okay, there's a point at which this thing's putting out too much output, and to not sort of transition into something else, perhaps a more robust, more meaningful, more, you know, some sort of activity that's perhaps more, you know, valuable and qualitative in the long term. I don't think a lot of our nonprofit organizations, Stephen, have a sense that their annual funds and their direct response programs, even their special events, a lot of the things that I call lane one fundraising, have a tendency to start to become like engines, like the engine in an automobile. And if you let that engine run too hard and put too much output, that engine's going to blow up. And once that engine's blown up, it's just not going to do you any good. It's not going to get you anywhere anymore. And I think that's what we see more often is you. And the other thing is that the efficiency and the output for which an highly efficient machine puts out is hard to pass up on. So if I can get one more donor to give one more gift next month at some extraordinary margin, as opposed to putting Steven or a member of his team out in the field and perhaps in a much less predictable sort of state. Yeah, he might have, you know, he might bring some better returns, but we may not know how predictable those returns might be. Isn't that some of the, what do you think about that, Steven? I mean, isn't that some of the problem that we've probably got with a lot of this highly efficient, high volume sort of fundraising activity? Is that something along the lines of what you're talking about?
Yeah, I think so. You know, I see coming out of higher ed and moving into the nonprofit, although higher ed, you know, is 501c3 as well, but higher ed is a different, it's a different animal.
Yeah.
You know, normally people are, higher ed is in their top three.
Yeah.
You know, if somebody's philanthropic, it's in their top three if they care at all.
Yeah.
In the nonprofit world, you may be in their top 10. If they're philanthropic, but you're probably not in their top five many times, particularly, you know, in the fraternity sorority space. And so I think you're right. I think what I've talked to my colleagues about in line with what you were just saying is they're putting so much into just limping along, keeping that engine going.
Right. Right.
Just keeping the engine going rather than really take it a risk. You think about how many small gifts, high-end annual fund gifts, make up $100,000 leadership gift.
Yeah, right.
How many of the small gifts? So if you go out there and get that $100,000 leadership gift, you don't have to do that. And they say, well, but we can't spend that, right? Because that's governed by a fund agreement. It's going to go into the endowment.
Yeah.
And I'm saying, well, yeah, you can't spend that right now, but you can spend the fees associated with setting up that fund and the maintenance of that fund. And that now augments your annual fund. And therefore, you have some flex. The other thing it does is when you deploy your advancement team, they get to see immediate impact on bringing in that commitment, that new commitment, that major gift.
Yeah.
Because they know it's supporting current operations and it's supporting future operations simultaneously, because it's going to be thrown in there, and the market's going to help grow that endowment piece, you know, based on spending policy. They're just going to grow that, but also you're helping the annual fund director. And so what it's done is it's pulled your researcher, your director of research advancement services, or however you got that set up on your organization chart. You're pulling that person in because Intel drives operations. You're pulling your major gift advancement team in because they're trying to support annual fund through fees management and also grow the endowment for future operations. And you got the annual giving person pulled in. Now you got a triad of directors,
yeah,
who all see the magic when you're working as a team,
yeah,
what you can do together. And now you're humming, right? You got all cylinders pumping. Every coil.
Okay, but so go back to your, because this is one of my critiques, and I have never thought of it in the context of that fund agreement. But I think we have built into our thinking. So the process I think you framed this up really cool. We're going to sit on this for a while. So you got the donor who you might be in their top 10, but ideally we'd like to be in their top 3. Annual fund will keep you in the top 10, but more higher engagement, more work that maybe leans towards something that looks like major gifts might get you in the top 3. But what we've also done with some of this meaningful engagement, this lane 2 fundraising that I refer to, is we've put things like these fund agreements in there. When you build in that fund agreement, you inadvertently, and perhaps we'd never admit this, but when you put that fund agreement in there, you actually set up the person who's sitting in annual fund with a rationale for which to keep the system going the way it is. The fund agreement becomes a unnecessary constraint. If your logic is that any major gift is going to necessitate some sort of a strings attached, some sort of a contract, some sort of an agreement, if you're sort of drawing the assumption that a much bigger check always comes with much greater, you know, expectations and we're never going to be able to meet them, that's going to give you the rationale to stay in the annual fund. That's going to maintain the status quo. Am I right?
Somewhat. I mean, I think I see where you're going with it. The fund agreement is meant to establish the parameters of a fund for the endowment, which is a perpetual agreement between the managers of that fund and the donor. So it's meant to be governed for the long term.
Right. But don't we? Do you think that some organizations are missing out? Your organization is certainly soliciting gifts of, say, six-figure, you know, $100,000 gifts that do not necessitate a fund agreement and do not necessarily have to go into the endowment. Am I right?
No, that is right. So I think I see where you're at now. So I think it all starts with, you know, raising the conversation.
Yeah.
To the greater good. You got to elevate the conversation. And when you do that, approach that conversation with least restrictive is best restrictive. Least restrictive is best restrictive. In other words, you're going to give it, but that's a whole different trust level. You know, Jason, it really is. I mean, you know, you're going to give me $100,000 and you're going to say, use it. That's why you got a board of trustees. Use it where it makes sense. I trust you.
Yes. Yeah.
I'm going to give you $100,000.
Right. I trust you. Right.
That's a high level of trust.
Sure.
The reason we get into fund agreements is because we don't quite have that trust established.
Right.
So now I'm going to give you $100,000. But because I don't trust you 100% to do what's best, I'm going to put some restriction on that. I'm going to say use it for membership development only. And You know, it can be for the greater good, but you have to use it to develop your executive, your chapter leadership team. That's what I want you to use it for.
Right, right. We're putting constraints. We're unnecessarily. We have designed fundraising to.
Yeah.
And I think we're doing this with our donors. I think the critique we're talking about here, Stephen, is so embedded in. If you and I were doing a session and we were talking to a room full of grant writers, I think grant writing is essentially the same thing as that. Is that fund agreement. We're writing these grants because we fundamentally don't trust each other. So whether it's the donor on one side or it's the organization on the other, neither one of us trusts the relationship. It's not a whole unlike what you and I are doing here. We're adding context into this relationship. So up until 20 minutes ago, you and I knew each other about as much as we could exchange on LinkedIn, and you sat in a seminar with me. Now we're having a meaningful conversation, and we'll add this layer of context. And I don't think in our fundraising efforts, I just think we're so damn impatient. I think we're so impatient and so unwilling to lean into the relationship that we'd rather put all these hoops in the process, but we're consequently undermined. And so what we end up doing is we either become dependent upon those cheap, shallow, what I consider to be very cheap, shallow, arm's length fundraising tactics like you see in your annual fund that never really put out the margin you need and always come with the highest cost per dollar raised, or you secure these higher dollars that are essentially embedded in what you're talking about in this lack of trust. And oh my gosh, if he takes my $100,000 and does something wrong with it, I'm going to shame the organization. They're going to end up on the cover of the Wall Street Journal or something. Right?
Yeah, no, you and I are singing the same tune right now. One of the things I saw happen as we finished 2020 was, you know, CARES Act allowed for some pretty beneficial tax incentives, right?
Yeah.
Like so on a major gift side, you could claim dollar for dollar up to your gross earnings for the year, which, and usually it's around 40%. And that was really cool. And so the organization said, oh, wow, we got these emerging donors. And I mean, the organization I lead, we have these emerging donors and we're going to go back to them. And there's this real tax benefit. And so if you're ever going to make a major gift, now's the time, right? Well, lo and behold, guess what? Some of them said, hey, we're still interested, but talk to us in 2021. And we're saying, well, but this tax benefit may not be there in 2021. Well, it's not that they weren't taking the benefit in 2020. They were. They just weren't taking it with us.
Yeah.
You see, because they had a higher priority. So it went to St. Jude's Hospital, or it went to, you know, Wounded Warriors, or went to. So they took the benefit. They just didn't take it with us.
Well, they took it. All they did was they took it with an organization that they had a higher context relationship with. Even if they had not had a meaning, likely with St. Jude, they had never probably talked to a real human being either. But they had been giving to St. Jude for 10 years. And so, they at least had been doing that those transactions had gone successfully. And I think that's one of I don't call it anything. I just read a book by an author, David Epstein is his name. He wrote a book called Range. And he's not talking about fundraising in particular, but he's talking about sort of this cult of early specialization. It's the cult of early specialization. And I think that's one of we can put this into the framework of a military career. Imagine, I remember my father and how he aspired to, you know, he retired as a W-4. So as an enlisted guy, the beginning of his career, and, you know, there's a specialization process or a maturing process that, you know, very well happened throughout his entire career. He had a long career, right? And had he specialized too early and sort of pigeonholed himself, which I think is what happens in the quote unquote annual fund for a lot of us, is we pigeonhole our careers and we get stuck in what Epstein calls this cult of early specialization. So we think that we're an expert at direct mail, direct response, special event planning, all of these sorts of things. We don't realize that this is going to define your entire career on relatively shallow work that's never going to pay your organization all that extraordinary margins, and ultimately it's not going to give you all that many meaningful relationships to engage with as well.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, it, number one, your dad had one of the best friggin' jobs in the service. W-4. Yeah. I mean, those guys, man, they weren't accountable to anybody ever. You know, that's a great thing.
For our listeners who don't understand this, so my dad went in like a lot of people, you go in enlisted, and I think it was 15, 20 years in, these guys have been around long, guys or gals, you've been around long enough where they recognize that you've been around long enough, we're going to have to give you officer status. And so you start to get respect from both the officers and the enlisted people because they know you've done your time. It's the benefit of time is what it is. We had a guest here on the podcast just a couple of weeks ago talking about longevity. I don't think we celebrate longevity, which is essentially what we're talking about here with the military. We don't celebrate longevity in this work. And that is what gets us back to that higher context relationship with that donor who's opting to go to give to St. Jude's versus give to your organization. You have longevity with the donor. You're going to get more meaningful gifts. That's the time to move that donor out of the annual fund and start talking to them like a human being.
You brought this, Jason, right back around to the trust factor. You brought it right back around. It's that deep trust, that trustful understanding. I mean, you become then the conduit to align intention with organizational requirements. And you become that trust conduit that brings those two experiences together. And then you own the responsibility then to steward that relationship for greater fulfillment, because it's really not just about a gift. It's about, you know, you're entering into a long-term marriage with that donor. You really are. You owe it to them.
Okay, so I'm bringing up all these books that I'm reading, but I'm working on a writing project, so you'll just have to forgive me. But Freire, Paulo Freire's educator in Brazil, in the mid-1950s and 60s, he's writing about how a lot of us in education are actually fearful of freedom. And what I'm thinking of, there's a freedom that comes from getting back to that question of why we let donors sit. Why we let donors sit in the annual fund for so long, why we don't move them out of the annual fund, and why we don't sort of experience that joy that comes with the work. Because you know as well as I do and most of my listeners do as well, that the more we let these donors move out of these highly mechanical processes, the more meaning they derive from the experience, as well as the more meaningful support we derive from those engagements. But there's freedom that comes in that. And what Freire would have told us is that oftentimes people like ourselves who get very comfortable in the annual fund, we get comfortable in those constraints. We get comfortable not having that freedom. I mean, freedom comes with a cost. It comes with consequences. It comes with that risk of extending yourself and having to get outside your box. I think we got tons of people out there who could be extraordinary, quote unquote, major gift types, but they're so damn comfortable in the annual fund that they won't sort of say, you know what, boss, I want to take somebody out to lunch. I want to learn how to have a meaningful conversation with a donor.
Yeah, I do. I think it's the short-term gratification that comes from linking your budget to the annual fund and getting satisfied that this person is a society member at $1,000 a year, when in fact you should replace that $1,000 a year person with these other never donors and develop that kind of relationship with them. But it's time to move this person from society level annual giving into something more substantive like that $50,000, $100,000, $250,000 gift. And
but Stephen, that's scary. That's scary. Yeah. I mean, isn't it?
It's hard work.
It's hard work. It runs the risk of complete rejection. That person might say, no, I don't want to talk to you. I love St. Jude's more. But it also might come with extraordinary returns, both for your organization. You might actually learn something in the process. Everything I've learned in fundraising has come from that willingness on my part to sort of extend myself or push my clients to sort of extend themselves beyond that comfort zone. And I think back on any of my career experiences. I'm sure you can relate this to your career experiences in the military as well as in fundraising. Most of the growth comes from pushing ourselves out of a comfort zone. And I think getting all the way back, yes, to where we started with the annual fund. The annual fund is just the damn comfort zone, is what it is.
Yeah, it's just comfortable. Yeah, I agree. Yep, I think we saddle people in that comfort zone, and then what we do is we spend a lot of time on lapsed donor reacquisition and donor retention. We put a ton of effort into trying to retain the 40% who are always trying to leave us. They're always trying to leave.
They don't love you. Right. Let them go.
Yeah. They're looking for love in other places, you know. They're trying. And so we're trying to hold on to them, and in the amount of effort that you're spending on those 40% that are always trying to leave you is taken away from them, from perhaps your the real prize, which is at those leadership gifts.
Who do you think, before I let you go, we hold on to our listeners for about a half hour, and I think we've kept each other going pretty well. This has been a great conversation. But who do you think? You think it's the manager, or you think it's the front line, the fundraiser? So is it the person in your seat, in my seat, or is it the boss who's more hinged on those metrics, like the renewal rates and the lapsed donor rates and all those sorts of things, because it maintains the status quo? Or do you think it's really, because I think a lot of times we think that those metrics are the boss's metrics, and so we're always trying to adhere and meet up to his or her expectations. But I think in some ways that's part of that comfort zone too, is that if I can just keep that renewal rate doesn't really say a whole lot. It just means that those people who may not love me just keep giving to me. They keep throwing trivial gifts at me. But I think that's part of that. What's that?
Go away money, right?
Go away money. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I've had to convince a lot of naive fundraisers. You know the people. I'm sitting in a workshop, a live workshop, and I've got a row of annual fund types in the very back row. They've all got their hands tied like this, and they hate everything I'm saying. I've had to convince them that the trivial gift even exists. They don't even believe that a less than meaningful gift can even happen. And I'm like, sorry, folks, there are people who are writing you checks that just don't love you that much. Right?
That's a fact.
You're on the bottom of their list. You're in the number 10 spot. You're lucky you're not in the number 11 spot or not even making the list, but you're not in the top three.
Right. Yeah. No, you're right. And
so what do you, is it our metrics or the boss's metrics? What do you think?
I think it's governance metrics. I think it's governance. I think it's by putting those metrics as many as you can in front of the board, then I think the governance group, that board of trustees, board of directors, it's comfortable for them to understand. A lot of these people come out of business and finance. It's easy for them to understand their role if they have a lot of data in front of them. And so then they put the thumb on the CEO to deliver on those metrics. And then, you know, I'm going to use a military phrase. Troopy does what the checker checks, right?
Right.
So Troopy does what the check. So if that's what's important to my boss's boss, guess what? That's what's important to me. So now I'm focusing on the metrics that are going into the dashboard rather than closing this trust gap between me and the most beneficial potential major donor prospects.
Yeah, I mean, you got a trust problem. What we're describing here is a culture that's sort of conditioned on a low trust bar all the way around, because that trust is sort of institutionalized from the top down. And so you're exactly. I think you're right. I mean, you've got these. It's very hierarchical, sort of top down management, and that board member who's a stickler about the metrics. He or she is sort of zooming in on that every month. And what that's doing is it's maintaining a system that perhaps isn't really going anywhere very quickly. And their eyes haven't been opened. And he or she is a, you know, CPA at a big accounting firm or something in Indianapolis. And so they don't, they're not thinking about the high touch relationships that are necessary to sort of move the bar in a, you know, real significant way.
Right. Yep.
Stephen, this has been a very engaging conversation. I think you and I could keep each other going for at least another half hour, but we lose our listeners at about 35 minutes in. You and I have some common bonds. I should introduce you. I think you're probably about 10, 15 years younger than my father, but I'm sure you guys could have some interesting conversations as well. If there's somebody out there who's listening to our chat and they want to reach out to you, how would you suggest that they do that?
They can find me on LinkedIn. I mean, that's how we connected. I think business wise, that's a real good way to do it. Stephen M. Bloomer, with Phi Delta Theta National Foundation. You'll find me on LinkedIn. We can make a connection, and then from there we can decide, how best to develop a stronger relationship. But I love mentoring. I also love learning. So coming on with you and having the opportunity to banter back and forth, I'm sure I'm going to reflect on this and pull away a couple gold nuggets, Jason. So I appreciate you the opportunity, all right?
Have you read the book that nonprofit leaders and fundraising professionals alike are calling a must read? In this pocket manifesto for today's fundraising professional, Jason deconstructs why many of us find ourselves working for organizations where we cannot accomplish our goals. These same organizations are notorious for rapid turnover and high donor attrition. To avoid this all too familiar path, Jason offers direction from those who want to be recognized and admired for their work. The war for fundraising talent challenges our ingrained beliefs and assumptions about how effective fundraising really works, and it questions the prevailing wisdom hiring decisions and donor behavior. Published by Gatekeepers Press, The War for Fundraising Talent is now available on Amazon and other major retailers. We want to thank you for listening to today's episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's show and hope you will come back for next week's interview, where we will discuss with those on the front line who are defining what it means to be a fundraising professional. If you'd like to be a guest on the Fundraising Talent Podcast, visit our Facebook page or email Jason at jason@lewisfundraising.com. In your email, be sure to tell us about where you work and why you believe you would be a great addition to the upcoming lineup. Thank you again for joining us today, and we look forward to you being a part of the continuing conversation as we shape how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent.